All right, so if everything goes as planned, this will be our last class in Daniel. We'll be finishing up chapter 11 and then going through chapter 12. And we went through chapter 11 pretty briskly, and it was kind of, I felt like it was choppy, but it's just because each verse was a prophecy of a different situation, a different time. And so each thing had its own description and explanation. And we're going to have a little bit of that in our verses that we're covering tonight and the rest of chapter 11. But then I think the rest of the chapter is more of a cohesive prophecy of future events. So since it's our last class, we'll go ahead and review these themes one more time and our chapter keys. We want to remember when we think about the book of Daniel, just that God rules the kingdoms of men. And that's highlighted throughout the book, not just in these verses, but also to be faithful in suffering, whether it was Daniel being taken into captivity or the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the furnace or Daniel in the lion's den. They exemplified the concept of being faithful and standing up for what is right and not being made to change to what is wrong. So our chapter keys here, chapter 1, taken to Babylon and tested, and then chapter 2, and you see these 2 and 7, 3 and 6, and 4 and 5 go together, so I've connected those, so I'll do them in that order. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream and interpretation, and chapter 7, correlating to Daniel's vision of the four beasts, the fiery furnace, correlating with Daniel in the lion's den. And then Nebuchadnezzar humbled and restored, and Belshazzar humbled in chapter 5. And again, those were the first chapters in Hebrew, but then the following ones were in Aramaic. And then when we get to chapter 8, we go back to Hebrew. And because this is more of Daniel's visions, it's not so much a public record of events, but these are the visions that Daniel is sharing with the Jews so that they can be strengthened in their faith during this period of time that's called the silent years, the time between the testaments. And we'll see that as they were reading these things throughout that 400 years, they could be comforted knowing that God was not silent during these years. God's talking to them through each of these events that was happening, and they were seeing them fulfilled in especially in chapter 11 and 11 specifically, but the visions stretched over such a period of time, 500-600 years, and so they could see those things playing out. So Daniel's vision of a ram and the goat, signifying the Syrian and the Greek empires, Daniel's prayer in the 70 weeks in chapter 9, and then 10 through 12 really is all one, but I broke it up. An angel tells of the kings of the north and south in chapter 10, and then chapter 12, the time of the end. So we'll jump right into where we left off in chapter 11. And the commentaries, especially the one that I used to help me with the side-by-side listings of the chapter or the verses in the Bible and then the fulfillment of those prophecies from history, they stopped the side-by-side at this point, so I had to do my own, so just a disclaimer on that. But there's some various opinions on what happens at this point. Those who are skeptics and don't believe in the authenticity of the scriptures will say that this is where the time period of when Daniel is written. Because the things that he prophesies after this, they say didn't come true, because they are reading it as this next king that's going to be discussed here is Antiochus Epiphanes continued. And so they say, well, Antiochus didn't wage another war. He didn't have success. And it doesn't talk about his death. So Daniel was just giving history up to this point, and then when he came time to guess of what was going to happen, he was wrong, and so we can see it. This is not inspired. And I completely disagree with that, of course, partially because, as we talked about, there was the Dead Sea Scrolls had parts of and fragments of Daniel, and those would have been as much as 385 years old, and at least 200 years old, which would have been before this time period of when they were saying it was written. But I think the main problem with them, with their, well, one of the main problems is that they are interpreting it incorrectly as Antiochus IV. I think his time period is done, and I think we're moving on to a new kingdom. John, did you have a... Okay. So the question is then, who is this king in verse 36? And many will say this is Rome, and the Roman Empire, and the Caesars, and there are some pros and cons to that. And if you want to keep that in your mind as we go through, you can see how maybe this could represent Rome. And I'm not saying that that's wrong, but as I studied and read through it, I felt it more accurately described Herod. I think the entrance of Herod on the scene as this new independent or a Jewish power, and the interactions he has with the people that perhaps we see described here, I think really fits more to me to be more accurate. So we'll take a look at that, and you can decide for yourselves who you think this is. But in verse 36, we read, "And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods, and he shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished. For what is decreed shall be done." And so we see Herod was appointed governor in Galilee around 47 BC. And really his method of ruling was a reign of terror. If you posed any kind of threat against him, you'd find yourself dead. And so he killed his, I believe it was his mother, some brothers, wives. You know, there was just no one in his family was safe because they could pose a threat to his throne. And then he had this power that he came to. Let's see. Oh, we'll talk about that in a minute. But there is question as to what the indignation that is accomplished is referring to. And that could be one thought is it could be the massacre in Bethlehem of the babies, and when he was trying to kill Jesus. But the more possible or another possibility would be the crucifixion of Jesus or the destruction of Jerusalem. So those things all happened under the Herods, not specifically Herod the Great, because he died around 1 to 4 BC, but it's kind of like with the Rome and the kingdoms have been, or the kings have been representing kingdoms before. It's very possible that this king represents more than just the one Herod. So in verse, any ideas on that or comments? All right. So in 37, he shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other gods, for he shall magnify himself above all. So again, Herod was really a Jew by political convenience. He became a Jew so that he would be able to reign and rule in that area. And again, he was willing to kill his family to maintain his power. He didn't really respect God, but used him as a tool to accomplish his own will. Or so he thought, and just that self-centered attitude really, you know, that really is what I think of when someone says he shall magnify himself above all. He was all that mattered in his maintenance of his power. So then in 38, he shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. So he was a builder of fortresses. There's Masada, Herodium, Alexandrium, Hyrcania, and Machaerus, along with the port city of Caesarea that we read about in the New Testament. He was one of the most, had the most expansive building projects of Palestine during that time. And so, again, he was doing those things so that he could fortify his areas and maintain control of his lands. And those basically became a god to him. And so he put many of, you know, much riches toward it, and ended up having to raise taxes and raise taxes to pay for all those projects. So he shall deal with the strongest fortress and with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many, and he shall divide the land for a price. So Herod enjoyed the backing of Rome, but his brutality was condemned by the Sanhedrin. He was named as Tetrarch by Mark Antony in 41, which was not actually Rome. That was the south of Ptolemies in Egypt. But then after some turns of events, he came out on top and was appointed king of the Jews by the Roman Senate in about 40 or 39 BC, replacing the Hasmonean family. So he was definitely a savvy political player. He knew how to get things done for himself. And we, in history, this, I believe, is, we'll see in just another minute, because we're going to have another force come in here. But again, Herod definitely did honor the people who would honor him with money and land and so forth. So in verse 40, in verse 40 we read, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships, and he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. This is one of the main parts that I see why this is a third king. He's between the king of the south and the king of the north. And so, one, as we read this first part, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. There's no record of the south attacking Herod. And when you go back and look at the Hebrew on that, it's not really the word attack, it's more push or press. And so we see that it looks, because Herod was named as Tetrarch by Mark Antony, it appears that the south was pressing Herod to help them in attacking the north. And so it's can really change the meaning by going back to the original word in the text. But the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind, and the chariots and horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall come into the countries and shall flow over them and pass through. Oh, I forgot to mention this. In 39, he was talking about the help of a foreign god. Herod set up a golden eagle at the entrance of the temple, which represented Rome and their power, and that was really an affront to the Jews because of it was a form of idolatry to them, and so that did not help him with the Jews, but it did help him with the Romans. So Herod is backed by Antony in the struggle. So Octavian and or between Octavian and Antony, and Antony lost at Actium in 31 BC. So there was the fight between the south and the north, and the north came through and attacked them. At this time, Herod had some problems. We read in Josephus, Herod had some issues to deal with in Edom over on his east side, and so he went to fight that battle while Octavian and Antony were fighting at Actium. And when that happened, Antony lost, even though, and so Herod was kind of fortunate that he wasn't there to participate in that battle, because he would have been conquered. But then when he came back, he went to Rome. He had to go to Rome and answer to the Caesar. And he basically said, don't be as concerned about who my friend was, but that I was loyal to my friend. And so saying that, you know, I showed loyalty to my ally. And now that you're my ally, you can see that I'm going to show loyalty to you. And so the Caesar bought that. And so he thought, well, that sounds like a good guy to have on your side, at least for the time being. And so he was able to maintain power despite the change of rulers. So we see and that really was the end of, we're going to see that this comes to the end of the Ptolemies and the Greek kingdoms. Because when Antony was defeated, he went back and he heard that Cleopatra had, you know, the one we know about, Cleopatra had killed herself, and so he killed himself, and then it turned out she hadn't really. And so she went and tried to curry favor with Octavian and couldn't win him over with her wiles, and so she ended up then killing herself later. And so that was the end of the Ptolemies. So in 41, it says, he shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. And so again, Josephus tells us that those had been attacked by Rome, but they had never been conquered by Rome. So that fits very well. As we go through, continuing this campaign, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and silver and precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. So he's conquering all through northern Africa, basically. And so when we see the history, Rome did conquer those nations. So that fits as well. And then in 44, but news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. So it sounds like there could be information coming to him that there's problems, that some of his greatest challenges, or Rome's greatest challenges that they had faced, were with Parthia, which was in the east, and Germania in the north. So that fits with their that history. So in 45, it looks to me like the king of the north has gone off to deal with those problems. And so then we're left in 45 with the only remaining king on the scene. And it says, and he shall pitch his palatial tents between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. So, first of all, the word seas is translated sea in many translations, and so a lot of people think that this refers to the Mediterranean, between the Mediterranean and Jerusalem. And so if this, we'll start with the thoughts on that this is all, that this is still Rome. So they would establish a presence in Palestine, and then the king would go off and end up dying with no one to help him. And so Augustus, or I believe it was, or Octavian, went off after this and never returned to Palestine. He ended up dying in Italy. It's interesting, and it strikes me that it could be Herod, because if the king of the north left, and so that leaves just Herod as the only king left in the story, then it fits very well, because Herod pitched his tents, palatial tents, between the seas. And if we're using that as multiple seas, then that could be between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, and then between the seas and Jerusalem. And that's exactly where Jericho was. And Jericho was where he had a palace, and he died a very painful death in somewhere between 4 to 1 BC. And I was reading about it, and it said that even Herod even attempted to kill himself, but was prevented by his cousin, and so he just was left to waste away and die with no help. So I thought it was just interesting. I didn't find, you know, this is one of those things where I kind of am out on a limb, because I didn't find anybody who, any of the commentators or teachers that held that particular thing. But when I was reading Herod's history, his biography, it sparked in my mind that he died in Jericho, which was between the seas and Jerusalem. So it fits very well, even if it's not, you know, if it is Rome, then I'm fine with that. But but it looks to me like it's Herod. So that gets us through 11. Any comments or questions on that? All right. So in 12, at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And so this appears to be at that time after whether it's after Herod or after the original conquests of Rome, and Rome getting into Palestine, that's when these times will occur. And so it gives us a very good idea of the setting as far as time-wise. And it fits very well along with Matthew 24 and 21 through 22, where it says, "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short." And so we see a parallel almost of these passages, and I think that's because they're identifying the same event. This would be the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem. And so we see, again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but Michael, who is identified as Daniel's prince or their prince, and so he's coming back to help. And so that fits with Revelation 12, 7 and 8, and we'll go ahead and turn over there, because we'll come back to this, some ideas here, because Daniel is a great help in understanding Revelation, and Revelation is a great help in understanding Daniel. Verse 7, it said, "Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven." So this is the description of what Daniel's seeing from earth. And then when we read in Revelation, it's what God's seeing from heaven, the fight that's happening and the victory of Michael over the dragon. So the last thing of last part of verse 1 was the people would be delivered, everyone whose name is found written in the book. And, you know, what do you typically think of the book when you hear that terminology in the Bible? The book of life? Yeah. That seems to be the case in this, that these are God's saved people that are being delivered. And so Revelation later will have the same, very similar discussion about the book of life in chapter 21. In verse 2, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." So this is some sort of resurrection, but this does not appear to be, so this is resurrection that is here, "many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake." And so it doesn't say all. And so this thought by some to be the final resurrection, but I don't think that that's what that's talking about here. This is many of those who sleep in the dust shall awake. And I think that is a terminology that's used to describe the revival of the nation for judgment. And so people are going to be stirred up and caused to take action one way or another. And when the Romans attacked Jerusalem, there were two camps, those who flee and those who fight. And those who were Christians had been told, when you see these things, run. Don't wait, don't stop, don't pass go, don't collect $200, run. Get out of there so you can be safe. And the Jews who felt like they were they weren't listening to Christ and felt like they had the right to be there, they fought and died in the process in the destruction. So people were going to be stirred up to take an action one way or the other. And so some to everlasting life and some to shame. And it parallels somewhat the dry bones of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel is talking about I kind of took little sections out of 11 through 14 just to save space. But our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are indeed cut off. And then God replies, "Behold, I will open your graves and raise you from your graves, O my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel." So it's just another parallel of God lifting up his people, reviving his people, and giving them a chance for salvation. And unfortunately, the majority did not take that opportunity, and so they perished in the destruction. Julie?
And so it can be just from being Jewish to making the change into Christianity, then, too. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
And then being so happy when Jesus brought kind of a revival.
Right.
What's right is right, and there's something more than how our spiritual nation is acting.
Yes. And so the opportunity to have a restart, basically, of getting back to what's right. And so some people would be attracted to that, and other people would not want to participate in that, whether it's for personal reasons or whatever. They felt they needed to reject that. So as we continue in 3, it says, "And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." So the righteous will receive glory. And and this is a, well, the rest of this goes on in 4. But it's really, I think this is talking about the disciples, the apostles, the people who were accepting the word and then going out and teaching and preaching it and sharing the gospel with those people around them. And so they would be shine like the brightness of the sky above and like the stars forever and ever. Verse 4, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." So this prophecy says it's for the time of the end. But the real question there then is what end? And so as many like premillennialists, they will see this as the end of time, and so bring in things that don't really belong, whereas we can see that this is a continued discussion of the destruction of Jerusalem. And so he's saying, shut this up and seal it, and not that it needs to be hidden, but first of all, the sealing it basically certifies it as authentic and official, but then sealing it up has kind of the idea of hold on to it because it's going to it's going to be a little while, as opposed to in Revelation where he's given the scroll and he's told, don't seal it. These things are going to happen soon. And so we can see there was the prophecy of it that was going to be a while, and then Revelation, the prophecy that, okay, it's about to happen, and you need to make sure everybody knows what they need to know. John?
Could it possibly have reference to the scroll in Revelation?
I think it's just similar language. I think John...
Daniel say, seal this up until the end of time, which you're talking about the scripture. So I have that as part of Revelation where it's talking about that, where that scroll is being revealed, being revealed to John to write down, and that's part of the Revelation.
Yeah, I definitely think they're both talking about the same thing, yes. And so, you know, I don't know if this is that scroll specifically, but I mean, I don't think so because that was a vision. But that they both have the same purpose, is to warning the of the end of Jerusalem. So then, as we continue in 5, then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others stood, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? So we just see kind of the setting of the vision and the people involved, the beings involved. And it's interesting. I don't know if the person asking didn't know the answer or if it was just setting up the presentation. But for whatever reason, there's the question, how long will it be till the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the water of the streams, he raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it would be for a time, times, and half a time, and that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be finished. So, he raises his right hand and his left hand. He's giving an absolute vow of promise. And he does it by the one who lives forever. So by he's promising by God that it'll be a time, times, and half a time. And, of course, we've heard that number before in Daniel. But we also, I think this is where Daniel is preparing John to be able to continue with this work. So 3.5 something. But that 3.5... would also be when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be finished. So the shattering of the power of the holy people, I don't think it is necessarily the shattering of the holy people themselves, but the system and the things that identified them as God's holy people. And so that would be the temple and the altar and all the things that go along with that in Jerusalem. So when that was totally destroyed, then that was the end of that those wonders and those signs, because that was the fulfillment, that was the purpose of them. So the siege of Jerusalem lasted 3.5 years, and so it fits perfectly with there were times where they would press and then pull back because of political things going on, and so I always love to read about that where they would pull back, and the remaining Christians that were there were given a chance to escape. And so then they would press again, and over the course of 3.5 years, finally to the end of it, and the temple was completely destroyed. And, So I think that shattering of the power of the holy people is the temple representing their relationship. Any comments or questions on that? All right. So in verse 8, it says, I heard, but I did not understand. Then I said, oh, my Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? And he said, Go your way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. So Daniel tries to get more information about what's going on and what the result was, and he said, that's not none of your business. I'm giving you what you need to know, and I'm telling you things that, even though you don't understand what they mean at this time, the people who receive them when the time is right will understand them and be able to act on them. And so Daniel kind of gets put in his place a little bit. But who wouldn't, you know, be curious and want to ask more questions? I mean, so he says in verse 10, many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. You know, I skipped over something that I wanted to hit. That reminded me of it. Just back real quick in verse 4. Daniel's told to seal up the book until the time, and many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. When I first read that last part, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase, I kind of got the image of people like running around with like chickens with their heads cut off. You know, it sounds like they're totally disorganized and so forth. But the more I thought about it and studied it, the running to and fro like that is not going to increase knowledge. So the going to and fro, that appears to be the apostles, the other disciples throughout that New Testament period, going out and spreading the gospel. And so, and up to the point in Matthew 24:14, Jesus, again, this is they're asking about when is the end going to come? When is the, how will we know? And Jesus says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. And so I think that going to and fro and knowledge increasing is the prophecy of this, what Jesus is talking about. And that was then fulfilled by the apostles and the disciples in the New Testament. So we got back to verse 10. Many will purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined. But the wicked shall act wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. So, it's basically saying that the righteous will understand the signs of the times, and they will act accordingly. They will do righteous things, make righteous judgments, and specifically, they will flee Jerusalem to safety. And so some would repent, some would be won over, and others would not. And so the ones who were going to act wickedly would remain in Jerusalem. And I don't know if you remember from our Revelation class a while ago, but the evil, wicked acts of the Romans against the Jews were nothing in comparison to the wicked, evil acts of the Jews among themselves. They just did terrible things to each other as the end drew near. And so Josephus, if you want to read more about that, you can. Josephus details some of those things. But they're going to be put in a situation where their wickedness is going to compound. And sometimes, you know, it's one of those situations like when you tell a lie and you have to tell another lie to cover that lie and so forth, and that and the snowball effect of that sin. Well, that's what these people are going to be feeling and doing as their wickedness just mounts and compounds on itself. Joe?
About that, and it says the wicked won't understand. they choose not to.
Yeah.
They choose that other way. You know what I'm saying? So, and that's generally the case with regular. And you know, the other side of it is those who have insight, those who have heard the word and have insight, they look.
Yeah, and we see that with in Jesus' ministry, where the Pharisees and Sadducees would come asking questions, trying to test him and trap him, and he would give the perfect answer, and it wouldn't be like they would say, oh, you're right, we should follow him. They would just be disappointed that they hadn't got him and embarrassed and try to figure out another way to trap him later. So they just let it pass right over them. Instead of accepting the truth and pursuing righteousness. Any other comments? All right. So we see in verse 11, and from the time from the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1290 days. Blessed is one... is he who waits and arrives at 1335 days. So this is one of the more obscure or difficult to nail down references in Daniel. But first of all, the in verse 11, well, one thing that people sometimes interpret this or how they read it is they're saying, from the time of the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1290 days. But I don't think it's not from here to here, it's from here and here. And so I think these are both connected and linked events that are happening at the same time, and that is the beginning point of this 1290 days. 1260 days is mentioned in Revelation, and that works out to 3.5 years. And so I was trying to figure out why 1290 days, and so I went to the Hebrew calendar, and there was a mention of a correction month. They didn't use that word. But I found that the Hebrew lunar year is about 11 days shorter than the solar year, and they use a 19-year metonic cycle to bring it into a line with the solar year, with the addition of, oh, here it is, the intercalary month every 2 or 3 years for a total of 7 times in 19 years. So I don't know if, I didn't go back and look to see if this was one of those time periods where there was that extra month in there, but for whatever reason, Daniel is inspired to say 1290, which still, in some cases, was 3.5 years. And so it was just an interesting choice there. Anybody have any knowledge on that subject? All right. So the idea is that from this starting point, and he gives two identifiers to mark it, it's going to be 3.5 years. And it was interesting, if we go back to the 77s, that it was halfway through the last seven that, how was that described? Let's see. In chapter 9. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to the sacrifice and offering. And on the wings of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decree end is poured out on the desolator. So I think that matches up perfectly with what's being described here and what actually took place on it, taking a literal 3.5 years for the siege of Jerusalem and total destruction. So he says, after that 1290 days, or that's how long it'll take, blessed is he who waits. Yes?
Oh. 1290 days,
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's their correction amount that made it, just like we use leap years to catch up and have the right number of days. Yes, so then, blessed is he who waits and arrives at 1,335 days. So, why 1,335? Why 45 days longer? I have no idea. There are a lot of people who are coming up with thoughts of guesses and things, but nothing I could find really rooted in biblical explanations. But I think it just represents being able to understand that our persecution, our tribulation, is for a limited time. And we're going to be facing trials and temptations here on earth for a limited time. And they were going to be under siege for a limited time. And if you can endure through that with God and make it, you know, just that 45 days past, you'll be delivered. You'll be free from that. And so if we can overcome our challenges and make it through, whether it's a particular challenge that we're facing here on earth today, and it's, you know, stretching out and we're just having trouble dealing with it, but we're bearing through, if we can do that, then we'll be delivered. And if we can do that as a whole with our lives, bearing through the frailty of this body, the frailty of our spirits as far as wanting to give in to temptation and seeking our own will instead of God's, if we can bear up under that pressure and that tribulation, then we can be delivered as well. And we will be blessed if we endure that. So the righteous can and will outlast the suffering that is brought upon them. And so then in 13, it says, "But go your way," speaking to Daniel, "go your way till the end, and you shall rest and shall stand in your allotted place at the end of the days." So I think this basically is Daniel being told that he's got his role to play, and he needs to be the prophet proclaiming God's power throughout the silent years and preparing the people for the end of the age. The silent years, there weren't multiple prophets during that time, but there was Daniel who had been given 500 years of prophecy, 600 years of prophecy. And so he was still prophesying throughout those times. Every time some event would occur and they could see that it was a fulfillment of those prophecies, that God was faithful to them, that they could know that they would be delivered in the end, that it wasn't all lost. They could see that the end was coming, that the Messiah was going to be coming, and all the messianic prophecies of Isaiah and the Psalms, and those things could be relied on because the same God that gave those prophecies was the God that prophesied through Daniel. And so having those confirmations time and time again would be able to strengthen them against the challenges they faced and help them identify when the Messiah would come and then be prepared for the new kingdom that had been described as a stone cut from the mountain without hands that would come and crush the kingdoms of men to complete dust and grow as a mountain that would take up the whole world and would last forever. And so it's a very encouraging letter or book from Daniel to those people. Joe? Yes.
It says that 490 days that's going to be set up. For me, I'm reflecting on setting up, finishing up God's word at that point. Thereafter, the destruction of Jerusalem, completion of it being written down, the letters completed. That's what I'm saying in the New Testament. So I don't know if that's true, but when I think about it,
Yeah, I looking at it there. Yeah, and depending on and when you think the last books were the last book was written, that can impact.
I've thought about it, I've never really researched it.
Yeah, but I think that's an interesting thought. But I think the thing that's being set up is the abomination that makes desolate, and so I don't necessarily think that would apply to the scriptures being fully revealed. So, but that's a good thought. Yeah. So that is the book of Daniel. I hope it has been informative and helpful, because the book itself is absolutely helpful. And so if you're ever discouraged or feeling down, turn to Daniel and you can be lifted up, whether it's through the stories that Daniel and his friends endured or just the sheer volume of prophecy that's been fulfilled, and you can be lifted back up and strengthened for the challenges that you face. Oh, yeah.
But on that resurrection part, what we're talking about, where people are going to be basically die or be resurrected, and some are going to be resurrected to
eternal life, right?
However you want to put it. You're not necessarily going to heaven, per se, that's not the final resurrection, but then some are going to be before the torment with that. But when I think about that, I think about Jesus, and when he died and was resurrected, conquered death. Before that, he dealt with death. You know what I'm saying? So, after Jesus was resurrected, he conquered death, and that's when these people rose to this point, like the rich man Lazarus, where they were in the unseen world. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, are they, you know, it's just a thought. Are they resurrected to that world at that point, or before they were just asleep and dead?
Well, following that thought, the resurrection that would be possible at that point, when Jesus, after Jesus dies, is not that they weren't actually in life after death, but that resurrection to overcome sin actually became possible at that point. And so it was, God was operating basically knowing that he was going to pay the price, and so people were able to avoid all going into torment until that time. So that could be that resurrection really was fulfilled, or that the idea of that resurrection was fulfilled with the blood of Christ. Yeah. Right.
And Jesus is the one that conquered that death. So when I think about that, that's kind of how I think about the scripture here. You know, it's, we talk about that resurrection. This is the final resurrection. We know that.
Right.
And so it's, to me, it's kind of like almost like an awakening from that point where, hey, at this point, now we have a Savior. There can be a judgment. The dividing is taking place. Savior goes all the way back to the beginning of time.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So before that, there was no dividing taking place because Jesus had to give the price. So when I think about that, that's the way I think about it. It's like, okay, after Jesus died and resurrected, that's when all these people, right back to the beginning of time, they got divided. They were resurrected from one side, one went to another.
Yeah.
And that, it's a thought that I've had about that. And that's something that you got to kind of come from.
Right. And the rich man Lazarus were divided prior to Christ dying. So it's an interesting thought to go back and look at that. Any other comments or questions? All right. Well, thanks for the opportunity to present this class. Let's close with the word of prayer.